Now, this morning it is my great privilege to introduce our next plenary speaker. Dr. Ian Hutchinson is from the UK. He did his undergraduate work at Cambridge University in physics and then went to the Australian National University for his PhD in physics. He then went on to MIT, where he spent 3 years physics, back to the UK for 3 years with the UK Atomic Energy Authority, and then returned to MIT for good, where he's been ever since, another 34 years, he tells me. So he should know his way around by now. And all that time, he's been in the Nuclear Science and Engineering Department, and for a significant period of time, he was a chairman of the department. And his research has been focused, of course, on nuclear power and fusion power. And given the theme of this conference, I believe many of you will be interested in those topics of nuclear power and fusion power. And I know Ian would be more than happy to fill you in on more details if you catch him in the hallway or at in the dining hall. He can give you the latest on the outlook of these. That's not going to be the focus. Well, he'll work it in. I know he'll work it into his talk a little bit, perhaps, but that's not his focus here, so you can get his expertise later on. Now, Ian doesn't do only science. He has devoted his time to considering science and faith issues. He's a frequent speaker at with Veritas and a continuous contributor to ASA meetings. He has been a plenary speaker before, but I think it's about 15 years or so since he last did. It's been a while. It's time we heard from him again. And a number of years ago, he published a book called Monopolizing Knowledge, which many of you, I hope, have read, where he explains the concerns of scientism and its pervasiveness in our society, and encourages us to understand different sources of knowledge, including that of revelation. Now, the talk he's going to give today is not primarily on that. It's called The Technical and Spiritual Challenges of Sustainable Energy. And while I've heard Ian give a number of talks, I suspect I'm going to hear something new here and something he may not have talked about before. But it's always a privilege to hear from him. So please give Ian Hutchinson a warm round of welcome.
Excuse me for a moment. I've been instructed I have to put this microphone on. Thank you for the opportunity to be with you and speak about the technical and spiritual challenges of sustainable energy. The first time I gave a talk on approximately this title was actually in the year 2001 at the annual meeting of the American Vacuum Society, purely professional society, and I was invited to give this talk. And there was a very big audience in the room, actually people standing at the back. And it wasn't necessarily a particularly sympathetic audience. In fact, several of the people told me at the end that they had come anticipating that they would be offended and angered by what I had said because they were purely secular in their outlook. It's a pleasure to give this sort of talk to a very different type of audience. I'm inspired to say I don't know how to follow the speaker we had this morning. It'll be very different in its outlook. So let me give you an outline of what I want to talk about. I'm going to divide my talk into three sections, speak about energy and its sources, technology and its limitations, and then spend some time with Christian perspectives and resources for sustainability, and particularly in the area of energy. I'm not aiming to be controversial, but I was born in Leeds, that's in Yorkshire, and Yorkshiremen are known for being kind of down to brass tacks, as they say. In other words, I'm a kind of direct speaker. So I will be direct, and perhaps you'll find this a little provocative. I hope so. Perhaps that'll make things lively. We'll have time for questions, certainly at the end, and comments. But urge you to take the view that I do, which is I think it's valuable to have a dispassionate assessment of the facts of the situation and to separate that from the very important passionate advocacy that we as Christians and as people of faith will have for what we think is ethically right action. So please, in a certain sense, save the passion for part three. So energy and its sources. Energy intensity is an expression which talks about the amount of energy we use per capita. And if you compare that with financial prosperity, you discover that these two things go very strongly together, not with perfect correlation, but with a remarkably robust general trend. On the left-hand side is a graph of energy consumption in the U.S. as a function of year over time. The time prior to World War II is compressed. But these are the different usages of energy, coal, petroleum, natural gas, and so on. And this red line is the GDP, the total economic activity in terms of money, also as a function of time. And those two curves go very much together. Again, not perfectly proportional to one another, but as a robust general trend. The same general trend appears if you compare, on the right-hand side, different nations and regions. And this is a graph where the y-axis is the GDP per capita. Here's $50,000 US per capita spread over the nation or the region as a whole. And here's the per capita power consumption, and it's expressed in kilowatts per person. So here's North America, where we use nearly 10 kilowatts on average per person of energy consumption, and the average per capita GDP is almost 50,000. And down at the bottom end are people who have small per capita primary consumption and small economic activity and financial resources. You can also express this in different ways, but I'm going, in the interest of time, to skip that. So financial well-being and energy consumption are very closely tied together. Actually, though, money isn't everything, as we know. And it's important to take a rather broader view of prosperity and development than simply finances. And one way to do this that's commonly used is what's called the Human Development Index. This is an index which consists of three parts. One is the GDP per capita, but the other two parts are the life expectancy at birth and the number of years of schooling that people experience. And if you combine those three, you come up with this Human Development Index, which runs from 0 up to 1, and 1 is sort of, in a certain sense, perfect. And what you find is there's still a very strong correlation between that Human Development Index and the per capita primary power consumption, which is along the x-axis here. But it's no longer a straight line. It's now got a kink in it. It rises dramatically at low values, and it saturates. And the knee in this curve is in the vicinity of 3 or 4 kilowatts per person. That's approximately where the knee is. Above the knee, you can increase the energy consumption. You don't substantially increase the Human Development Index. The fact that Qatar is using 20 kilowatts per person actually doesn't mean they have a better Human Development Index than, let's say, the USA or Portugal, for that matter. But much below the knee, there is a very rapid drop-off in the prosperity of humans, and there are very many people who are in that part of the curve in the pre-development types of nation. So energy is tremendously important for human welfare, whether it's money or whether it's a broader view of development. Now, energy comes in different forms and is used in different forms. I'm going to use the US as an example to show you what fractions of energy we use in different areas. But the US is fairly typical of the industrialized world. We can think of really four main sectors of the provision and usage of energy. They are electricity, transportation, industry, and buildings. So the electricity line is 40% of the total energy consumption of the US, and that is taken out of these other categories, the electric part of them. So these are the non-electric part of these things. Transportation is an important part, and industry also uses over 20% of the total energy usage in the US. This buildings line is basically heating of commercial and residential buildings. This other column of the table is the percent of each of these sources in the US that is provided by fossil fuel. So in the bottom three, all of them use more than 90% of the energy that is provided for transportation, for industry, and for buildings comes from fossil fuel. But in electricity, it's just under 70%. So what you see from this table is electricity is the largest sector, and it's the only one that is not totally dominated by fossil fuel usage in the US. Transportation is 95% petroleum, buildings is 99% gas and related fossil energy. Industry uses, by the way, a lot of fossil energy for its processes, and it uses a lot of it, this is directly, rather than using electricity or other things. What do we deduce from a table like this? Well, one thing you can deduce straight away is that if we merely electrify one of these areas, let's say transportation, this would actually not do very much to reduce our dependence on fossil energy. Because what it would do is it would take that 28% of our energy usage, and instead of it being consisting of 97% fossil energy, it would then be electrified, but then it would be using essentially 69% fossil energy. So it would be a sort of slightly less than 20% drop of the usage of fossil energy. But I am going to focus on electricity because electricity is an area which is smart energy. It can be used for all kinds of different things. And also, it is the area of our energy uses that is most easily addressed and converted into using sustainable sources that are emission-free. So, in other words, to summarize, we can lower electricity's 69% fossil, and we should, and we can raise its 40% total, and we should. So let's think about US electricity generation from different sources. And what I want to show you is how it has been changing in the last 15 years, between the year 2001 and the year 2016. And these bars are the total amount of electricity generated from different primary sources, solar, wind, biomass, etc., gas, coal, and so on. And what can we see from this? Well, first of all, let's just look at the top of the bar. Between 2001 and 2016, the total energy usage in the US substantially increased. So the first thing we can deduce is that as far as conservation, which is also a very important consideration when we're thinking about sustainable energy, conservation is losing. We are actually increasing our energy consumption in the US. If you look at the top of this bar, there is a very thin line, and that is all the solar electricity that was generated last year. It's visible now. It wasn't visible on this bar chart in 2001. So but it is still a tiny fraction of the total electricity generation. It's growing, but it's tiny. The bar just below it, however, has grown and become significant, and that bar is wind energy. So between 2001 and 2016, wind grew to be no longer an insignificant amount of the electricity that we generate in the US. Biomass has not grown very much and isn't likely to under present economic conditions. Nuclear and hydro are the green and yellow lines. They have an amount which is approximately constant between 2001 and 2016. But if we look at the two dominant fossil lines, the total fossil energy has actually
increased, the use of fossil energy to generate electricity has increased in those 15 years. But something quite drastic has happened. The amount of coal that's used for generation, this blue, has shrunk very substantially. And it's almost all been taken up with using natural gas to generate electricity. Now, the primary reason why these things have happened are economics. We had a question on Friday night about what it costs to generate electricity with various different sources. And here is a slide about the costs, the economics of electricity generation. The way it's best to think about the cost of electricity generation is to levelize the costs of that source over the lifetime of the generating power plant or whatever it is you're using to generate it with. And this is a chart of the estimated levelized electricity generation costs in dollars per megawatt hour from different types of electricity generation. Dollars per megawatt hour is probably unfamiliar to you, but if you divide all these numbers by 10, that converts it into cents per kilowatt hour. So if you pay any electric bills, then you probably know what you're paying in cents per kilowatt hour for your electricity. And this would be, for example, 6 cents per kilowatt hour. The costs are of different forms. It costs money to build the power plant in the first place, and that's the capital cost. It costs to a certain amount of fixed operations costs associated that with to maintain the plant, whether or not it's running. And then there are the costs of running the plant, and those are predominantly, in almost all cases, the buying of fuel. And what you see is that there are two types of electricity generating sources. These are called dispatchable and intermittent. The dispatchable ones are the ones that we can turn on and off, essentially at will. And they are not subject to the vagaries of the climate, whether the wind's blowing, whether the sun's shining, and so forth. The intermittent sources are subject to those kinds of fluctuations. So if we look at these, what you see is the cheapest is actually geothermal, but we're not in a position to expand that terribly much at the moment. But the cheapest in widespread use is natural gas. Actually, natural gas has two bars on this curve because it comes in two types. One is labeled CC, that's for combined cycle gas plants. Those are the types of plants that are run in order, essentially flat out, to make electricity all the time. As a result, they have what's called a capacity factor that is approximately 80% or more. In other words, they're run for 80% of the time, essentially generating as much electricity as they can. But because of fluctuations of both demand and other sources, we need to be able to follow the load, as Annabelle explained very well on Friday. And so therefore, you need to have certain sources that you turn on and off. And these are typically conventional gas plants, which are also very easy to turn on and off. And they have a separate curve. And they generate more expensive electricity. And the reason is primarily because they're only run with a capacity factor of about 30%. So you've got a lot of investment standing idle for the rest of the 70% of the time. And it's consequently, the effective costs of those top-up plants in terms of capital is very much larger. Nuclear power plants, we still have more than 100 nuclear power plants in the US, and there are actually four currently under construction in the US. But their costs are almost entirely capital costs. So there's a little bit of fuel costs and operations costs on top, but mostly the cost is the investment of building it in the first place. Hydro, coming to the intermittent side, and essentially all of the intermittent sources are also dominated by the capital costs, the blue part of these curves. Hydro can't be expanded terribly much in the US, and the reason is because basically we've dammed most of the rivers where it's convenient to dam them, and we've built hydro plants in most of the places that
one can.
But of course, the areas which we think most of in terms of renewable energies these days tend to be wind, which we've already mentioned, and solar. Wind is competitive these days in terms of its installation. By the way, I didn't explain that these are estimates of the levelized electricity generation costs for plants that would first come into operation in 2022. So these are the costs of new power plants. They're not the costs of past power plants, which are much harder to estimate. So these are what it would cost to build new power plants that came into operation in a few years. So wind is relatively competitive. Solar, of course, is something that we've heard a lot about at this conference and is very interesting and important. What you see is there are two lines for solar. And the difference between these two lines, like the difference between the gas lines, is primarily to do with the capacity factor. But the capacity factor of solar isn't determined by us wanting to leave a solar panel idle. It's determined to do with whether the sun's shining or not. And the capacity factor that one can, the best capacity factor that one can get in the US is with solar panels installed, for example, in the high deserts in Arizona, where the sun shines all the time and it's very favorable. And one can get a capacity factor of about 25%, because after all, the sun just doesn't shine all the time, so there's no way you can get a 80% capacity factor from a solar panel. But in Massachusetts, where it's not so sunny and and the latitude is higher, the typical capacity factor for solar plants there is only about 12%. And as a result, the cost is about twice as much for solar power in Massachusetts as it would be for a power plant installed in a desert in Arizona. Again, these are projected future costs, not exactly current costs. However, my church in Belmont, Massachusetts, is in the process of installing a solar power solar power panels and related system, because Massachusetts gives very substantial incentives, economic incentives, for solar power. And without those incentives, that power plant would not pay for itself on any time that would be attractive whatsoever. But as it is, the estimate that we've made is that it will pay for itself in about 8 years, even in Massachusetts. Now, CO2, of course, emission, we've heard a lot about so far and its effects on global warming. That is, of course, the main waste and emission from fossil fuels. And one way to think about CO2 is to ask the amount of CO2 that is emitted per capita, per person. This is in tons, and here is our US line. It's telling us that each of us here in this room are responsible on average for emitting something like 18 tons of CO2 per person per year. That is typical of highly industrialized nations, although actually Europe is substantially lower in its emissions and in its energy use. Approximately speaking, wherever you go, the energy use is going to follow the CO2 per capita. One slight difference there is in France, for example, which has just under 80% of its electricity is generated by nuclear power. It is slightly smaller than the average of European nations in terms of its CO2 emission per capita. But there is no example currently in the world of an industrialized economy that has a significant lower per capita CO2 emission than Europe. Even China, for example, and Hong Kong combined now are essentially up to the level of per capita CO2 emission of Europe. And if you go to undeveloped countries like Uganda, they emit hardly anything. Now, what about the future? CO2, if we care about it, is going to
cause the earth to warm. And it's worthwhile asking the question, is there a way that we can avoid that warming or limit it at any rate? And one target that's been suggested by various panels and so forth is to try to limit the global temperature rise to 2 degrees and to limit the amount of CO2 that's emitted to a level that would not cause a warming of more than 2 degrees. And these graphs that I'm showing you here are graphs of models produced by some MIT economists. And I want to warn you, first of all, that these are not predictions. They're models. They're what-ifs, if you like. And secondly, I want to warn you that economics is not a law of nature. And so it's influenced by lots of factors, okay? So we should take these with a pinch of salt, but we should take them as illustrative of what might happen. So the idea is these models are trying to address the question, what happens if we limit fossil fuel usage by a carbon tax or some kind of carbon fee such that its usage declines between now, from 2010 to 2100, and as a result, the use of fossil fuels decays to a level which is sustainable with this 2 degrees global temperature rise. And if you suppose that the costs of energy remain what they are, the best estimates that are made by the International Energy Authority, and run these economic models that these economists at MIT have developed, this is what happens to the total energy usage in the world. It still rises, and remarkably, it becomes completely dominated by nuclear energy, according to this model, this run of this model. On the right-hand side is electricity. Electricity becomes even more dominated by nuclear under this scenario. There's a certain amount of bioenergy in this model, but nuclear becomes very predominant. And that's really driven by economics. It's driven by the assumed costs that have gone into this model, taken out of the IAE estimates. But you can run other what-ifs, and you can say, well, okay, supposing we decide that really nuclear is much, really going to cost much more than is estimated by the IAE or IEA, or you suppose that it's simply socially unacceptable, and so people decide we're just not going to build that many nuclear power plants. So what happens if you constrain nuclear? The scenario comes out differently. The nuclear is constrained. It's now a small fraction of the total. And instead, we still have to reduce the fossil energy usage to a level that's going to be sustainable. Bioenergy takes over in this scenario. There are other scenarios. You can suppose, I personally don't think this would be in the least bit sustainable because the land usage and so forth associated with this much bioenergy would be catastrophic, but this is coming from a physicist. What do I know? But anyway, the difference also is that the peak level of energy usage turns out to drop a little bit, and this is what the economy shows. So what's the point? Economics is going to drive the energy usage that we use as a globe more than anything else. And there are various options that lead to different results. We can't predict the future, but these are examples of what happens, what the economists say would happen under certain scenarios. So let me come to the end of my first part, which is to address this question of the global energy situation. Fossil energy is, in the long term, unsustainable. It is causing global climate change. If we want to prevent that global climate change, we need to reduce the fossil energy usage by approximately a factor of one-tenth. Now, it needs to become one-tenth of what it currently is, roughly speaking, in terms of controlling the global CO2 emissions. And those graphs that I just showed you showed it coming down drastically. To do so would, of course, naturally implies a massive restructuring of society, even at our present global energy usage. But if a global population of 7 or 8 or 10 billion people all consumed energy at the US rate, then actually our CO2 emissions would be increased per capita as a result of that. The average would go up, and the total usage in the world would be about 10 times what it currently is. I don't think that's credible, but I'm just saying if everyone had the degree of energy usage and consequent prosperity that we have in the US, and there were 7 or 8 billion of us, then in fact we would have to reduce by a factor of 100, because it would be starting from 10 times higher to get down to the same CO2 level. And I think that replacing all but 1% per capita of fossil fuel usage is not just a technical challenge. It's more than that, okay? But let's talk about technology, and I think that's where it brings me to the idea of the limitations of technology. When we talk about energy in our Western world today, the first thing that most people think about is a technological fix. What developments in technology can we bring to bear on the challenges of sustainable energy? And that is in part because we are a very scientistic society. We look to science for answers to our knowledge questions, and we look to technology for fixes to our social and practical problems. Now, that isn't so bad. As Randy mentioned, I have studied and worked in fusion energy research for most of my career. That's the attempt to bring down to Earth, if you like, the energy source of the sun and stars and make practical nuclear fusion energy available on the human scale. I think that is a worthy scientific and technological endeavor. I'm proud to have been a part of that effort and to have done it. But I think it's vital for everyone involved in this very important sustainable energy type of research to recognize that there is no magic technological bullet for energy or for any other sustainability challenge. And that's based on the simple arithmetic that I've already outlined for you. There's no technological solution for energy. No matter how successful technological innovation is, the Earth cannot sustain a population of 8 billion people at the American level of per-person energy use. There is no technological fix, I believe, that could give us that ability. And part of the reason why I say that so emphatically is that technology is always double-edged. One might even say it's multiple-edged, but it cuts both ways. It has unwanted side effects. Nuclear technology, which is the one I'm most familiar with, is routinely recognized as being double-edged, as having unwanted side effects. And so in addition to providing emissions-free power, it has worries to do with, for example, proliferation of nuclear materials and consequent weapons capabilities, or worries about safe disposal of used waste and so forth. And sometimes this double-edgedness of nuclear leads to calls in many quarters for its abandonment. But it's not so widely recognized that every technology, even the most benign technologies, is double-edged. It has unwanted side effects. So, you know, not to pick on sanitation, which is one of the most greatest boons that technology has brought to humankind over the last 100 or 200 years. It nevertheless, even if you pick the most benign technology you can think of, it has unwanted side effects. In the case of sanitation, what it does is it brings health to people who previously were dying, and as a result, it brings population growth, and as a result, there's an increased impact on the environment. So that's an unwanted side effect of even the most benign of technologies. And very often with technology, we're in a situation of what you can think of as being a vicious spiral. We start with some problem, might have been a problem produced by technology. We introduce another technology to satisfy it or solve that problem, but that leads to other bigger problems, and those problems have to be fixed, and so we bring in a more powerful technology, and those problems have to be fixed, and so on. So this, we are very often in technological development as a society as a whole in a situation where we have a vicious spiral. And it can be rather like the old lady who swallowed a spider to catch a fly. Eventually, that led her to swallow a horse. And if we're not careful, we in a society as a whole are going to be swallowing a horse. Exponential growth is actually instability. What we need in terms of technology and problems is to reverse the direction of the spiral. We need to start with big problems, introduce technologies that have smaller problems and smaller problems and smaller problems. And so we need to get ourselves onto virtuous spirals. But one of the great difficulties that we as engineers and scientists face is that our economics colleagues and politicians, for that matter, have taught us for decades that growth is what we want. But actually, what I'm saying is, no, it is not growth what we want. What we want is the opposite of what economists say. We want stability. We want a situation where instead of things blowing up, they are calming down. And that's a significant problem. Now, technology, I've asserted, cannot solve the problem. Actually, technology has been criticized right from the beginning when it started to be implemented. And so the Luddites, for example, complained about the fear of that the workers would be impoverished by the introduction of power looms back in 1811. And the word Luddite, of course, has become synonymous with the unthinking and irrational rejection of technology. But unfortunately, rejection or critique of technology is not always irrational. Sometimes it's rational. And in fact, the opposite is the problem that we face today. We've reached a situation of excessive reliance on technology. And as Randy mentioned, I wrote a book some years ago about scientism, which is an excessive reliance on science, and the claim that science is essentially the source of all real knowledge. And that is a distortion of science. It is a distortion which needs to be critiqued. And the critique of scientism is to say that, well, actually, no, it's not the case that science is all of real knowledge. There are lots of other important areas of knowledge. Well, technology has a parallel kind of distortion. If we excessively rely on technology, we reach what is sometimes called technopoly, an excessive reliance on technology. And its critique is we need to call attention to the fact that technopoly leads to injustice. There are people who have been criticizing technology more recently, and technopoly is actually the word that Neil Postman used to describe technology run riot, excessive reliance on technology. He also pointed out back in the 1990s that scientism and technopoly go together. And just as science, real science, and technology are mutually dependent, so also scientism, the unwarranted belief that science is all of real knowledge, and technopoly, the undue dependence on technology, they are also mutually dependent. And it's critical, in my view, to repudiate both of them. But if I might just pick out two of the technology critics of the 20th century, Postman I've already mentioned, Jacques Ellul actually came before him, and he published his book La Technique in French in 1954. It was translated into English 10 years later. But he is a very important critic of technology, and very widely read. He was actually a theologian. If I can just use his summary, his characterization of what he called it technique, but I'm going to use more frequently the word technopoly. He said the problems with this technique are, first of all, automatism, that essentially everything that is not technique is being eliminated. Self-augmentation, which is this vicious spiral that I was explaining to you earlier, that he talked about things in terms of a geometric progression that poses new technical problems. He talked about everything being inseparably united in this technological viewpoint. Even organizational techniques are coming to dominate, and eventually technology spreading until it takes over the whole world. Remarkably, for a theologian, in my view, Elul doesn't really offer much solution to the problem of technopoly, nor actually much hope for one. It's a very intractable problem. Neil Postman, in his comparable critique, actually does offer some prescriptions for what to do. He says we should be a loving resistance fighter. For example, although it's not speaking as a Christian, take the great narratives of religion seriously. And he also talks in terms of reforming education. And his prescriptions, I think, while admirable, are, as far as I can see, totally inadequate, and for energy or for anything else. And so that brings me to the question of whether there are some perspectives and some resources that we as Christians can bring to bear to help with this incredibly intractable problem of sustainability, in particular sustainable energy, which is my main topic. The underlying problems of sustainability in energy or anything else are not mysterious. They are really this: human population and human consumption. It's too many people wanting too much stuff. Those have no technological fix. Technology mostly makes the problems worse because it gives us additional power to pursue those inappropriate ends. But perhaps they have spiritual solutions, and I think our faith addresses them. Christianity offers very substantial resources of the type we need. And the type of resources we need to address these problems of sustainability aren't technology, they are values. They require a change of values. Values are not things that are provided by science and technology. I don't mean to say that science and technology are value neutral. Actually, they're not value neutral. They often usurp the true human values that we as Christians embrace, and indeed most unbelievers also embrace if they're pressed hard to think about it. Science and technology are dangerous in that sense, that they can usurp the values that we really need to emphasize. And what resists that is robust moral principles that are more than arbitrary choices. So much of morality these days in the developed West is portrayed as being the ability to make autonomous choices. But we, as Christians, have different viewpoints. We have robust moral principles that are more than evolutionary accidents because they arise from transcendence. And quite frankly, wanting too much stuff is pretty well addressed in the Bible. It's called covetousness. Why should economic expansion be endlessly sustainable? It isn't. Economic expansion cannot be an endless objective, and yet most economic and political analysis and aspiration acts as if it is. By contrast, the reasonable aspirations of us humans on the globe is for not the lifestyles of the rich and famous, but globally middle-class lifestyle. That would mean adequate housing, bicycles, buses for transportation, nourishing food, communications, etc. But for industrialized countries like ours, it would actually mean substantially reduced consumption, but not a less satisfying life. Indeed, I believe it would constitute a more satisfying life. But to embrace that requires a change in values away from consumerism. And values are largely matters of the spirit. That's why I think the spiritual challenges of sustainable energy are at least as great as those of the technological challenges. So what are our spiritual resources in Christ for sustainability? Motivation for the care of the earth. Seeing the earth as a God-given creation, and indeed as a stewardship charge to keep. So God put Adam and Eve in the garden, and he told them to tend and keep it. We have a moral authority that supersedes individualism. Sustainable economics and development requires global cooperation. There's a difficulty, and that is that moral authority springing from our Christian or other religious roots can't be just manipulated. But we have those resources and we need to bring them to bear. We also have principles of action and attitude, peace, justice, charity, equity. These are the necessary backdrop for addressing these questions. But I want to get quite specific, and I want to address specifically what about population and consumption, which is what I've identified as the key challenges to sustainable energy and everything else. Well, population is a problem. And it really needs some serious thought. God loves us. Didn't we have a wonderful sermon this morning? Daddy love. But God's love for individuals and the sanctity of human life does not mean more humans is better. It couldn't possibly mean that. Yes, we read, go forth and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it. Well, that, like other religious commitments from other sources, was spoken into an environment where there were very few humans on the earth. And multiplying was vital if we were going to fill the earth. But right now, the earth is full. We did that. So what we need as Christians, as the Christian church and as thoughtful intellectual Christians, is we need theological reflection on that changed situation. We have a changed situation, the earth is full, and reflection on that must become part of religious and specifically Christian intellectual landscape. But as far as consumption is concerned, we have all the resources we need. The Bible is very clear about that. Our teaching is unequivocal in condemning the consumptive attitude that pervades modern society. And just a few examples, if you go back to the Old Testament prophets, you can read in Amos how he condemns those who live in luxury compared with the poor. How Jesus himself said, blessed are the poor, and that it's harder for a rich man, it's harder for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven, or that you can't serve God and mammon, or as we read in the epistles, the love of money is the root of all evil. So those types of things about consumerism or the consumptive attitude are part of our commandment from God. I don't think we quite live up to it in the way that we should, but we need to take that seriously. I think one of the greatest resources when we're thinking about the care of the earth and sustainability is the whole biblical teaching about the Sabbath. Because when you read about the Sabbath, for example, in Leviticus and other parts of the Bible, it isn't what we often imagine, which is, you know, well, Sunday is for worship and we shouldn't work. Although actually, of course, most of us do work. It isn't so much about the humans. It's actually as much about the rest for the land as it is for the rest for the humans and for the animals and for creation. And so rightly understood, I believe that the Sabbath is as much about the environment and about the land as it is about resting from our activities. I'm going to give just one slide in which I give some policy advocacy. The rest of the slides, I've tried to pursue this slightly dispassionate viewpoint. Here's my passion, okay? I believe that climate is a shared global issue. And that I think individual action is tremendous. I don't want to criticize it, but it is not enough. So, you know, driving a Chevy Volt is great, okay? But it's not enough to have individual action. We need a coherent policy, nationwide, and ultimately we need a coherent policy globally. We need government and international priorities to reflect two true costs and true values. CO2 pumped out into the atmosphere is going to cost us big time. It's going to cost a heck of a lot of money and a lot of other things and suffering too. We should charge for it. We need political policies and tax structures that reflect real costs and resource allocations that reflect them. So, for example, some of the bizarre things that we do in this country, fossil fuel producers have enjoyed enormous subsidies for decades in the form of tax credits. Should that continue? No, it shouldn't. It's stupid. We shouldn't do it. Why shouldn't we have a carbon fee, or a carbon tax, to reflect the real cost of global environmental pollution by carbon dioxide? Answer, we should. It could be made revenue neutral and non-regressive. So there's no argument that I accept against it in the form of saying, well, you know, we should avoid big government. We could make this, we could do this without it building big government. Europe already taxes gasoline at several times the rate of the cost of the net cost, not just the tax rate, net cost of gasoline in the US. And as a result, gasoline is maybe two or three times more expensive because it's almost all tax in Europe. And the result is, well, Europeans drive smaller cars. You know that if you've been to Europe, you've seen them. And that's why they have more fuel efficient cars. So I think it's vital for us, in addition to whatever we do individually, which I think is great, is to recognize that individualism cannot solve sustainable energy problems or any climate problems. And the love of neighbor that our Lord commands us to should lead us to advocate for a national and international approach. Well, I pray that the words of my mouth and the meditation of my heart are acceptable to thee, my rock and my salvation. But whether or not they are, we're going to have a conversation. We have some time for questions. But let me summarize. Global warming is occurring. It's caused overwhelmingly by fossil fuel use. Sustainable energy is a vital necessity. Focused research in technology, for example, is worthy and it will help. But there's no technological fix for energy and the environment. At root, most sustainability challenges come from population and consumption. And sustainability requires human and spiritual resources and values. And these must be incorporated into global economics, laws, and policy. Our Christian teaching provides many of these resources. And we can be proud of that, and we can promote that. But our spiritual values often conflict with the assumptions of modern consumer culture. And we are too often caught up in that consumer culture. And in contrast, what needs to happen is that we as Christians need to be true to our true calling and our care for creation. Let me finish with one last word. I don't want this to seem too negative, although I think the challenges are immense, okay? Our Lord is sovereign, and he is the God of all creation. And we can trust in him, but he is also trusting in us. Thank you.
We have about 5 minutes for questions. And are the microphones? I don't see the microphones here. Did you have them?
Can you speak loudly?
Oh, here. Okay.
Wait. First of all, thank you. Second, I noticed that you said energy use and in different nations. And you said that nobody was doing a European standard of living at a substantially lower energy. So my question is, when you say a global middle class lifestyle, you list those things, is there a society currently on Earth or a subset of society where people in fact have those things that you mentioned and that type of life at a level of energy use that you see as perhaps being eventually sustainable? As a part of that question, is there technology that we don't yet have but might be envisioned that would help us move there? And then how can we get there?
Okay, thanks for that question. That's three questions. Did you hear it? First of all, is there an example of a country that is living a kind of energy lifestyle that might be sustainable? There are sustainable levels of CO2 emission on this chart, but they're basically the undeveloped countries. And so there are no developed countries, countries that live with the kinds of prosperity that we enjoy in the U.S., at that level. So that's the answer to question number one. The direction we have to move is we have to do what we can technologically to reduce CO2 emissions. We have to, and overall, we have to reduce our energy consumption very substantially. And what this shows is, for example, we could reduce our energy consumption in the U.S. by a factor of two without losing substantial amount of our prosperity, because Europe is an example of that. So there are examples of places that will use far less than North America in terms of per capita energy, far less, factors of two less, okay? But I think it's a combination of problems. I think ultimately, I don't believe there is a scenario in which a world population of 8 or 10 billion can live at the kind of level of material prosperity that we enjoy in the West. I don't think there is a sustainable scenario like that. And I think what we need is, in addition, is to think hard about doing something about the population. I know that hits all kinds of hot button issues, and so I haven't said much about that, except to say we need to think about that theologically as well.
Walt? You didn't say much about fusion. I know you've worked in this area. Is there any silver bullet prospects in that or not?
There is no magic bullet, period, okay? And fusion isn't it, okay? Just to answer more directly, there's a big experiment being built in the south of France called ITER, which, if successful, will be a scientific demonstration of controlled fusion energy. It'll generate 500 megawatts for hundreds of seconds at a time. But that's a long way from putting power on the grid. I don't think fusion energy is going to be available in my lifetime, and I think it's a far future. It will, if we pursued, you know, this nuclear scenario, we would begin to think that we might want to develop fusion on a more rapid timescale because it would become part of this mix. But of course, maybe it won't, because maybe nuclear won't be acceptable to people.
Yeah. Transportation is a third of our energy use, more or less. Yet transportation is, the way we have it, is a Western North American value. And it's also intimately related to land use. And these are coupled, and we value low density living and mobility upon demand, personal mobility upon demand. That's a sociological problem that we have to grapple with if we're going to make any progress.
Yes.
Question.
Did everybody hear him? Gas usage is built into our society and our expectations. We got to change that.
Jennifer.
Well, my question was related. I mean, when you look at the chart of the developed nations, it's the ones that are biggest, geographically speaking, that are using the most energy. So just moving goods around, trucking and so forth across the U.S. and these larger countries. What is your suggestion for reducing that need to move goods around large countries without using as much fossil fuel, and without, I mean, and if you tax the fuel, then wouldn't that make food prices go way up, which would most, which would hurt poor people more than the wealthy? And so, so I know that's all entangled, but I just
the fact that it's entangled is very.
Repeat the question.
Okay, so she's saying, what about transportation and the costs of moving stuff around and the fact that poor people are building our stuff and it's being sent to us and so on and so forth? So it's an entangled question about an entangled problem. These numbers that I'm showing here are the amounts of emission from countries. It's been pointed out very recently that this doesn't reflect the fact that the big countries, the powerful countries like us, actually are using more even than is shown up on these graphs. And the reason is because much of the manufacturing that goes to provide us with goods is no longer done in the US. It's done in China, for example, or it's done in India. And so actually the CO2 footprint per person in this room is larger than that 18, because there's fossil fuel being burnt in China to build the stuff, you know, that you carry around in your pockets. And so it's a very complicated business. To answer your question more directly, I don't have a solution. In the long term, our transportation needs to be electrified if it's going to move away from fossil use. We can imagine that there could be use of things like hydrogen as a fuel. But that's a long way from being economically attractive at the moment. But that's one possibility of reducing our CO2 footprint. And that's a fuel that you could imagine using, for example, in aeroplanes. I don't want to be so much down on technology as to ignore all the possibilities. There are many, many possibilities. But I don't know, I also don't want to predict what will actually happen.
All right, okay. Two more quick questions.
Given the current challenges that nuclear is having, what's happening in South Korea, you've still got places like China building, but the U.S. has got terrible economic problems with the plants it's trying to build. Do you see nuclear being viable in the U.S., given that our legacy plants look as though they're, many of them, going to shut down?
Okay, that's a so this is a question, is nuclear going to be viable in the U.S.? First of all, let's just look at the world as a whole. There were 10 new power plants came into operation, nuclear power plants came into operation in the world as a whole last year and the year before. So the world is building nuclear quite quickly. China is building nuclear like crazy, as fast as they can. And the reason is because their alternative is coal, and coal is killing their people in the millions per year by particulate emissions. So that's very pressing for them. In the U.S., we are actually in the process of building 4 new reactors right now, but there are cost overruns, there are construction overruns. We are also closing prematurely nuclear power plants because in many states they are not competitive because they have not been granted emissions-free credits, tax credits, etc., that have been accorded to wind and solar and some other things. According to this table, nuclear cannot compete for new power plants with gas at the present cost of gas. But the present cost of gas, of course, is extremely low. Whether it will stay that way for 20 or 40 years is less clear. I also might clarify while we're on this graph. You notice there's no coal on there. There's no bar for coal. The reason is because we're not going to build new coal power plants in the U.S., because the restrictions on air quality and related things and the economics are not right for coal. They're not great for nuclear. We need to get serious about charging for the CO2 pollution that fossil fuels cause before we will have a truly balanced economics. Sorry, that was a long answer to that question.
One more.
Have any of these studies taken into account the population distribution projected? And I'm specifically wondering, do you think we're moving towards more urbanization or deurbanization over the next decades?
I don't know what you mean by deorganization.
Urbanization.
Urbanization. I'm sorry, I didn't hear you. So that was a question about population distribution and urbanization. I don't know the answer as to whether urbanization is important or not, and maybe there's someone out there who does. If so, talk to this lady here. But in terms of the population distribution globally, obviously what's happening is the very big nations like China and India are industrializing. And that's one of the biggest sources of growth of fossil fuel usages in the world. It's very hard for me as a Christian to criticize that action on their part, because they're basically trying to develop prosperity for their citizens, who many of whom have lived and continue to live, particularly in India, in abject poverty, with using hardly any energy per capita. So the distribution of energy usage is another completely vital area, ultimately. And my projections are in part based on a belief that ultimately justice requires, and probably global stability requires, that there be development of other nations and that they increase their energy usage. If that's the case, we are going to have to decrease our fossil energy usage even more.
Okay. All right, let's thank Dr. Atkinson one more time.
If you have any further questions, I'm sure he'll be happy to answer it.